Welcome to the special edition of Generation Justice. Tonight is March 11, 2012 on KUNM, your community powered public radio. This is Adrian Rivas, and I'll be your host tonight.
And I'm your other host, Harika Reddy. Generation Justice is a multimedia project that trains youth between the ages of 13 and 25 to create media that is committed to inspiring social change.
Last Sunday, March 4th, we brought to you the issue of heroin and opiate addiction in New Mexico. Tonight, we will continue our discussion by talking with parents who have seen the deadly consequences of this addiction.
New Mexico's heroin problem is vastly growing, especially among teens. In fact, more 8th graders have tried opiates than high school seniors.
New Mexico not only has the highest accidental overdose rate in the nation, but we are 2 times the national average.
Tonight, we will bring you 2 brave parents who are willing to tell us about their children who died from heroin overdoses. Jennifer Weiss talks with us about her 17-year-old son, Cameron, who overdosed on August 13, 2011.
Haley was a beautiful, smart, and talented 16-year-old who was also addicted to heroin. We will hear a detailed account from Steve Paternoster, her father, about her battle with the drug that took her life.
Tonight's music is brought to us by Sound Oven. These are original songs written and performed by MAX, the Media Arts Collaborative Charter School music production class about drug abuse, a song dedicated to fellow student Haley Paternoster, and a remix of Cameron Weiss's own song about his addiction will be featured.
It will be a great show tonight. First up, we have Sound Oven with one of their original songs, Drug Peace. That is spelled P-E-A-C-E.
This is one area where we cannot have budget cuts, because we must wage what I have called total war against public enemy number one in the United States, the problem of dangerous drugs.
Grab a historian, cause back in 72 when Nixon was president, created the drug war, but living in ignorance, the creation of the DEA was said to be heaven sent, but selling to our streets is how they were getting in. An honorary member of the DEA was bringing his own drugs, from security searches, his name was Elvis Presley. Spreading my benevolence, but seeking out obscurantism, cause I'm living in blindness. Don't patient my kindness, just stand in the line stiff and ask why the lies spread. Stand up and fight for it, cause we calling it all in. Blaming young kids, cause we're moving the most hits. So crack cocaine commissioned by the CEA is how we got the real gold. As we stand in the line silent, life sentence is handed out like candy. Well, that's all fine and dandy, but stand up and grab your sanity.
Too often, the danger of addiction is not realized until it is too late and someone overdoses. Steve Paternoster's 16-year-old daughter, Haley, lost her battle with heroin addiction on April 8, 2010.
Haley's father, Steve Paternoster, has deliberately been open about sharing his loss and Haley's story so that other parents will not have to go through the hell that he has been through.
Our own Adrian Rivas has sat down with Steve Paternoster to talk about Haley's heroin addiction. You will also hear a version of Sound Oven's Haley, We Miss You along with this interview.
Hi, my name is Adrian Rivas with Generation Justice. Tonight I'm joined by Steve Paternoster. Steve Paternoster's 16-year-old daughter Haley lost her life to heroin. So Steve, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'm a local businessman here in Albuquerque. Been here a long time. I work at a restaurant here locally, and Haley, my daughter, was born when we first got to Albuquerque, and so she and I were very close, and she spent a lot of time in the restaurant where I work and spent a lot of time in this community that I live in, and it was a huge shock to see her go way, way before her time.
Can you tell us about Haley, like just personally?
Oh, yeah. She was a really fun girl, and she was a smart girl, a really smart girl, and she loved being involved. She loved being out there. She was somebody who really grabbed life and really lived it and had a good time. She loved to ski. She loved music. She loved people. And later on, it was those qualities kind of started to disappear as she discovered drug addiction.
So I want to jump ahead and
go ahead.
I want to ask you to describe your last night with Haley.
I work part-time at a school. I'm on the board of regents of a school in southern New Mexico called New Mexico Military Institute. And I had a meeting that morning in Roswell, so I went the night before. And it was a tender time, and it was one of those things where I thought, okay, she's been okay for a few days. I'll go. I'll get right back. I went to Roswell. I went to my meeting. I got up early the next morning. It was a breakfast meeting, and you know, I had email on my smartphone, so I was checking my restaurant sales from the night before. And I noticed that one restaurant's credit card machine hadn't batched. So I called home. My wife was in the shower, so I called Haley's phone. Woke her up, and I said, "Hey, Haley, we got a problem with one of the credit card machines. Would you make sure it gets batched?" She said, "Sure, Daddy, I'll be happy to do that." And I said, "Will you let Jane know?" "Sure, Daddy, I'll be happy to do that." And she called me back. "We're all set." So I checked in with Jane, and she was having breakfast with the other little boy. And so I go on about my day. So I'm sitting in this meeting, and I look down, and my phone has rang, and it's my wife, and it keeps ringing. And so I finally stand up. I walk outside. And I call my wife back and I said, what is it? What's going on?" She said, "I just found Haley on the floor. She could have been down as long as 22 minutes. She's not breathing. No pulse." How she had found her on the floor was my youngest son, Jameson, they were getting ready to leave. My wife was heading to work and Jameson was going to nursery school. Jameson was about 2.5 years old, I think, at the time. Jameson had knocked on the bathroom door and said, "Bye, sissy," and no answer. And my wife was at the top of the stairs, heading down the stairs. Jameson knocked on the door again, says, "Sissy, bye." No answer. So my wife tries the door. The door is locked. We have those kind of locks that you can take a butter knife and undo the door. So my wife ran downstairs, grabbed a butter knife, came up, opened the door, and Haley is on the floor, not responsive at all. And my wife called 911. 911 fire department was there within 2 minutes. They didn't get her breathing again. They got her heart started, and they took her to UNMH. And my wife is kind of feeding me these snippets of information. She said, "I don't know if she's going to make it. I don't know how long she was down. She was cold when I found her." And, you know, that's the one phone call as a parent you just don't want to get. So I'll never forget, I walked to the table. I grabbed my coat. I grabbed my notebook. I grabbed my briefcase. And I said, "Fellas, I think my daughter's just passed away." And I walked to my car. I got in my car, and I left Roswell. So abruptly, I left my stuff at the hotel and just drove home. And the trip between Roswell and Clients Corners, no cell reception. You're driving as fast as you can to get to your loved one, and you have no communication. You've got nothing but your own mind working on you. So when I could get a hold of my wife, she's giving me updates. Well, she's in the adolescent intensive care unit. So I get to Clients Corners. I get better reception. My parents are on their way. Her mother was there. My wife, of course, was there. Our sons were taken care of and being looked after. And so I'm flying. I get from Roswell to UNMH, I think in about 2 hours and 38 minutes. I go smoking into the parking lot. I get on the elevator and I get to her room, and she is lines everywhere and needles everywhere and a mask on her face. And it looks just like my daughter, and there's brain activity. So I'm thinking to myself, she's going to come out of this. And wait till she gets out of this. I'm going to tell her exactly how I feel. And then I sit there, and there's not much going on. You know, the breathing machine's making the noise. My mother's there, scared to death. My wife is there, absolutely beside herself. My ex-wife, who is still my very dear friend, absolutely beside herself. And I'm sitting there, and I'm just at the end of her bed, and I'm just pacing. And I'm looking at her, and I'm going, and I'm thinking, all right, I'll get her to get up. I look at her, and I said, "Haley, you get up." And you really realize at that point how little control you have of that situation. I couldn't wake my child up. I was a single father with her for many years. She and I lived by ourselves together. So we start getting some news, and the news isn't good. Brain activity is diminishing. Apparently, she was sick from withdrawals, and she had taken Vicodin that morning to kind of combat the withdrawals. Well, Vicodin, apparently, or oxycodone, whatever it was that she had taken, has a high amount of Tylenol. What do they give you when you have a fever? Tylenol. Her liver is toxic with Tylenol. They can't give her any more Tylenol to bring her fever down, and I'm watching her fever, I mean, a tenth of a degree every 15, 20 minutes it's going up. So I see her at 98, go to 99, 99.1, and so for hours I'm watching this creep up, and there's nothing they can do. Nothing. Her liver's not doing anything because it's already intoxicated with this overdose of Tylenol that she's got. She progressed downhill. About 10 o'clock, remember I got there about 1 o'clock. She was found about 8:41 or 8:42. About 9:30, 10 o'clock that night, I think, well, this is a reality check. You need to get a hold of a priest. It's a hard decision to make to get a priest in there to administer what you think are going to be the last rites to your child. And so the priest comes in, a great guy, absolutely a magic guy. When he came into the room, I could tell that he was spiritual because it comforted me. I'm a Catholic. I've been a Catholic my whole life. My daughter, thank God, she and I went together. I remember we spent a year. We went through classes together and catechism, and I'd grown up Catholic. I'd been baptized. I'd never been confirmed, and I'd never gone to my first communion. Well, she and I did all that together. And Father Campbell came in, and he administered a prayer for the healing. He said, I'm not going to do the last rites right now. And he did that, and he said, I'll be right close by. If you need me, just have somebody get me. 10:30, 11 o'clock, she's rallying a little bit, and I'm going, maybe we've turned the corner. And it wasn't to be. We didn't turn the corner. And about 11:30, I had to call the priest back, and he administered the last rites. And it made all the difference in the world to me, having the last rites administered. And it seemed to make her calmer. It was really kind of a transformative thing for me. I would not have survived that night, I don't think, had that not happened. And it was apparent she was failing. Breathing became more labored. I'm watching these screens, you know, that they have hooked into your child, and it's showing her temperature. It's showing what her heart's doing, her O2 saturation. I mean, there's all these measures. And for me, it's like watching the score of a game, and everything's not in your favor. And so we sat there about an hour and a half, kind of telling stories about Haley. And about 1:59, I was holding her hand, and she had a massive cardiac arrest. And when she had this cardiac arrest, just right across the street from where we're sitting now, right across the street on the same floor of the hospital she was born on, she had this cardiac arrest, and it was violent. And when she had that cardiac arrest, she had been laying down. She was, you know, non-responsive, completely non-responsive. And when she had this cardiac arrest, it was so powerful that it flung her arms out, and it brought her up out of the bed. And her eyes flew open, and she was fixated on a spot in the upper corner of the room. And she died. Now, they had said, well, we can keep her alive a few days, but I couldn't do that. I just couldn't do that. And I wasn't going to keep her alive while people took parts off of her. And so she died. And I can remember at that moment feeling such incredible loss. And I can remember thinking at that moment, if I can do anything for the rest of my life, I think that this is, for me, going to be a lifelong process of paying back the karma bank, paying back God for letting me get through this. If I can do anything on earth to save one child's parents from having to go through this, I think it will become my lifelong quest.
Haley, we miss you. Wish your mama could kiss you. Why'd your angel have to fly away? Haley, we miss you. Wish your daddy could kiss you. How many sisters and brothers have to die to you?
It ain't so easy, honestly. I'm doing a lot of work today with kids that are sick. And it's not work that's in the public eye, really. It's not me advocating at children's court. It's not me at the legislature. Looking for money and looking for solutions. This is a problem, man. we can't paint it as anything but that. What this is a chronic disease worse than diabetes that's being inflicted upon our state. We are the artery. We are the heroin artery. It's a tough story to tell. I'm working today, this minute, right? I just got a phone call right before we started this. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get a very sick girl into treatment. I'm a little shaky because it takes me back there every time I go through this. But it also, if I can get this girl to treatment, she's going to live. If I can't, she's not going to live. And so that's the driver. It is a chronic disease that can happen in 3 days. 3 times use of heroin on a child, it changes their brain chemistry for life. It can. They become addicted and nothing else becomes important. 3 days. It takes 3 days to go from being perfectly healthy to chronically diseased like you're a stage 4 cancer. Mm-hmm. And you can die at any moment afterwards. Isn't that a heavy statement? I mean, really? Can you imagine that you can lose a child? A child can become that sick. And then for the rest of that child's life, that disease is going to have to be managed because they've changed the way their brain functions. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you some economics on heroin abuse. My daughter was a $200 a day heroin user, $6,000 a month to sustain that habit. And let me tell you, it was probably easier for Haley to obtain money and drugs. I got to tell you, I certainly have credit cards in my wallet, and sometimes I use them, sometimes I don't. Sometimes I don't see them for a long time, and a bunch of credit cards got beat up. I was never mistrustful of my child until the very, very end. So money could disappear from my pocket. I had a beautiful watch that my wife gave me for my first anniversary. It and my iPod disappeared, and I blamed a contractor on it that was putting a kitchen in my house. It was Haley. And so what happened, so that qualifies the $6,000 a month. And they steal. They shoplift. Nothing becomes sacred in the face of the drug. You'll do anything. And you remember what we talked about before we got on the air, mm-hmm. what sometimes becomes the currency of the drug war?
Yeah.
Sex. There it is. We become outraged as a society over the stupidest things. But here's the outrage I want you to think of. Imagine the outrage you would feel if you felt like your child was being exploited by somebody you don't even know. That sex is a sacred thing that belongs in marriage. And all of a sudden, your child is having to perform that to get a drug that's no longer a recreation to them. You get high maybe the first 4 or 5 times. I don't know. I've never done it. I've just heard anecdotal evidence. But what she's doing is that she's going to the only pharmacist that she knows to have the drug administered to her that can only make her feel up to normal. And those kids, a child like my daughter's, worth $72,000 a year to someone selling that drug. The cost of that drug to the dealer or to whoever it is minimal. You know, I'm in the restaurant business, so we think of things in terms of cost. Well, my food cost is about 30%, and heroin cost to the dealer is probably 12%. So what does that represent? It represents a revenue stream to that person of $70,000 a year. Now, my restaurant is a pretty healthy business. So if you're a 21-year-old drug dealer and you have 50 children that are $200 a day sick, it's $10,000 a day. It's $300,000 a month. It's $3,600,000 a year that's being sucked by 50 kids. So here's the point that I want to make about that. The point is, those guys are relentless to these children. They text, and they text. You ever seen that television commercial where the guy's in the talking cell phone, and he's going, yo, send me pictures, call me, I love you, call me. And they're, and it's illustrating the dangers of the text. These guys are relentless like that. It's, yo, hit me up, I got the black. I was talking to this child the other night that I was telling you about that was ill, that I've spoken of in this interview. As I'm sitting there talking to her, her phone buzzes. She holds it up to me to read the message. Here's what the message said. She's 17 years old, this girl. How old are you?
16.
She holds the message up, and it says, yo, I got the black you want. Hit me up. And it's that easy. The cell phone unmonitored is not a good tool. The internet unmonitored is not a good tool. And what happens is the drug is very clever. The drug figures out ways around all of this. I'm telling you, it is frightening. I could never figure out where the heck Haley was getting her drugs. You don't know where she was getting them? Mm-mm. They were coming into the driveway. They were going right through her window. She lived on the second floor right above our garage, right through the window. They'd tie a rock around it or put it in a baggie with a rock, throw it up. She'd throw the cash out. That's it. That's not good. And so these guys are relentless. And your children, our children, are victimized, and they don't care. Some interesting facts about the heroin that comes into this part of the country. None of it is from Afghanistan. None of it is from anywhere clean. None of it's from China. None of it's from Afghanistan. None of it is clean. It is manufactured in Mexico, in the jungles of Mexico, in the mountains of Mexico, under the most deplorable conditions possible. You analyze a ball of black tar, you're going to find hair, feces. It looks like the scrapings off the bottom of your shoe when you've stepped on some gum and you walked a day. So what is it? What has to happen to a child to get them to want to cook that in a spoon and put it in their vein? There was a kid that died that I know his mom, and I care about her very much. He was a heroin smoker. And when he was in his hospital bed, unable to control any function in his body, his friends would come to see him. And you know what they'd do for him? They'd blow the smoke down his throat. Can you really get your head around that thing? So what happens to these children, they simply become an ATM that when it runs out of money, they throw them away. The analysis on the heroin that killed my daughter, it was 80% pure. What may have happened, she may have become a hindrance to the people that supplied her, and they decided that was it. It's time. So they feed them a hot shot. It's guaranteed to kill them. And they throw them away. My daughter was thrown away. She was fed heroin that was 80% pure. You know, when I was a kid, your age, that heroin that this whole generation of people, when we were children, that those guys were doing, 3 to 5%. My daughter was killed by an 80% hit of heroin. She was comatose before she hit the floor. She was seated in her sink putting on her makeup. Oh, I think I'll do a hit. She's on the ground.
Never forget you. If I had a path to heaven, I would come and kick it with you. I wish I could come and get you so your dad could hug and kiss you. I wish you never went through the pain of being misused, abused by sick dudes with issues. Like, it's cool, but it's sad. I get mad. I wish you were in school right now. Tell the haters pipe down and put the pipe down. Listen to this tight sound. It's midnight now. I'ma make it in this music for everyone who wasn't around to see me do it. And for everyone who clowned and said that I couldn't.
the things that I've said to you tonight, painful for me to talk about. Painful, ugly, painful. It's a pandemic. There's 300 new child addicts a month. There are 2 million people in New Mexico. 300 new child addicts a month. Taking $6,000 a piece at $200 a day. And I think that that's a pretty reasonable number. So that is 300 new addicts a month times $6,000 a month. It's a big dollar amount. And it cost me a bunch. It cost me a human being that's irreplaceable. And I will never forget that the rest of my life. It'll be the first and last thought every day the rest of my life. She would be pleased to see the outpouring, the students at Max, the music project they're doing to provide treatment, to provide social awareness. What those kids at Max are learning, what you're learning something that can't be taught. You're learning social awareness. You're becoming fully fleshed out, matured, concerned citizens before you get out of high school. If you weren't, we wouldn't be sitting here now. And so you got me started with one question. We're going to be here all night, so I should let you go on to the next question. But
well,
I'm glad
you
asked.
Some of mine.
I'm glad you asked.
Yeah. Well, after all of this, what are the changes in your life after Haley's death?
Oh, I can tell you this. I've spent a lot of time in therapy. And I got to tell you, the first 18 months were just dark. The first year, I don't remember much. I can remember thinking that I can't lose anything more. And so as I could put things down and aside, and I sold everything I had except Scalo, which it sustains me, and I'm really proud of it. And it has really, along with my awesome wife and my two sons at home and my two other sons, have kept me sane. The first year was a blur. And when things really got tough for me was April 10th, 2011. I finally gathered Haley's remains and took them from the funeral home and buried her. And she was cremated, of course, and I shared her cremains with her mom. Her mom had some strong feelings about wanting to, and I respected that. And then I took what I got. I held out a little bit to keep close to me, and then I put her somewhere where I can go. I needed to have a place where I can go the rest of my life to touch base with her. And there have been some other tough things. I mean, you know, you have to bury your feelings, and you have to find some outlet. And you know, the first place you go to your doctor and they give you drugs. Ironically, right? I can't take the drugs. They're too strong. The smallest dose is too strong. So couldn't turn to drugs. You turn to other things. You drink. You turn inward. And then there was kind of a day around December 1st of this year where I kind of came to a little bit. And I started to realize, you know, this is a forever thing. I have two boys at home that I care about a lot. I have an example I got to set for them. I have a wife that I'm crazy about. I have parents that love me and I love them. And it's been painful for my parents to see. But now I can find a little joy. But there's some motivation that comes out of it too. You know, the motivation to be here with you, this isn't fun. Really? I mean, it just isn't. Mm-hmm. But if there's one person that hears this and it changes them, it's good.
What is the most important message you want to give?
Easy. Real easy. And I want everybody to take a minute and stop doing whatever the heck else you're doing while you're listening to this program. And I want you to listen to this one message. Do not ever put this substance in your body, period. Prevention is the message. Treatment is a reaction to a problem that's already happening. We're not working on the prevention piece. We're just not working on the prevention piece. And why would you put something that looks like scrapings off of your shoe in your body for any reason. And why? Generally, when a child becomes addicted, an adult puts them there. Don't do that. Don't do heroin. Don't do coke. Don't do meth. Don't smoke pot. Do other things. Get involved. Work out. Or get into school. Or rap. Or write poetry. Or fall in love. Or do something else. Get involved in something that exercises your... There's other ways to touch those parts of your brain. Heroin is not that way. So the simple message, my strongest message is prevention. Don't do it. Don't do it.
What is your message to parents who are dealing with their child's addiction?
Parents, get a reality check here. If you think you're going to love the devil out of your child, you're not. You have to seek aggressive treatment. If they have access to money, cars, any resource, they're going to abuse that resource. They're going to abuse that drug. They're going to get anything they're going to do anything they can do to get access to the drug. You can't stop that. You can't love that out of their lives. The minute you go to sleep, they're out the door. The minute you go to sleep, that guy that throws the heroin through the window, he's going to be in your driveway. And he's not going to let go. It means a lot of money to him. One of the guys that was busted in Avis case used to drive around with his kid. The money's a very powerful pull. The drug's even more powerful. So parents, if you suspect, you're probably right. And you have to jump on the most aggressive thing that you can do. I had a lady tell me one day, well, you know, we think we can get him into rehab in the next like 90 days. And I said, well, then you need to get a handcuff and you need to lock that kid to you for the next 90 days because, ¿sabes qué? You're going to live if you don't. That's the message.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
There is. If you'd like to contact me, I'm pretty easy to find at Scalo, 255-8781. I'm available to help as much as I can. And I have some resources. They're limited. I don't possess the miracle, but we're developing more resources. Youth Matters, our foundation. If you care to send a donation in care of Youth Matters to 3500 Central Avenue Southeast, Scalo, where I work, Albuquerque, New Mexico, 87106, we would be grateful to have your donations. And we'll make sure that they get used in a manner that's consistent with making sure that kids get better. The Heroin Awareness Committee online or on Facebook, don't hesitate to get involved in any of these organizations. And if you have these kind of troubles, it doesn't hurt to get with people who have been in similar circumstances and will help you. So please, if you feel like there's help that you need, come forth and ask. I'll do all I can. I'm one guy, but I very much care about this problem, and I will try and point you the right way. I'm not a miracle worker. I'm one guy who's going to do everything he can to make sure this changes.
Well, thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Steve. I felt that your story was very compelling. This issue really needs to be shared with the community. Many people will be shocked by your story, but it really needs to be told. You really are a good man for continuing to help the community. Thank you for coming in.
I share the same sentiment as Adrian. I really respect you for putting your experience out in the community and for becoming a strong advocate against heroin addiction. Drug education is very poor in New Mexico, and I feel that your story has impacted me a lot more than any drug education I have ever had.
Addiction really is a lifelong battle. Sadly for Haley, her life was cut way too short.
Through her father's work and through the impact of her death, she will not be forgotten, and hopefully the Paternoster story will help others.
Many people want to believe that drugs are their only outlet, but for the young musicians from Sound Oven, music is their way to express themselves. Here is Sound Oven with Music Is My Drug.
This is your brain. This is your brain on music.
I make it bangers on my Mac and I stay banging on my drums. Music runs my life and that's how the cookie crumbs. Rule of thumb, don't succumb to some dumb cheap one. Cause life is a beat and I just kick back in the sun. I can't fix my mistakes, I can't handle what's been done. All I can do is fix my future and the future's yet to come. So I hit the ground running like the race just begun. Come to my conclusion that it's your profuse illusion. If you're choosing to use drugs, you're choosing to abuse them. Regardless of your illusion, life is
stay high on music and life.
Take the needle out your name, drop the needle on the track. Take the spoon out of the flame, flip the record, not the sack. Break the cycle, break the curse, catch the hook and lose the bug.
In New Mexico, the number of drug overdose deaths have surpassed the number of traffic fatalities. Teens are some of the highest casualties of deaths due to drug overdoses.
When a teen dies unexpectedly and way too young, it is a very traumatic experience for the family and the whole community.
Cameron Weiss enjoyed football and wrestling and had many close friends, but he suffered from a deadly addiction to heroin.
Cameron lost his battle with heroin addiction on August 13, 2011. His mother, Jennifer Weiss, spoke with Melissa Harris about Cameron and her story of watching her son struggle with addiction.
Hi, I'm Melissa Harris, and with Generation Justice, I'm here today with Jen Weiss, the co-founder and president of the Heroin Awareness Committee. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
So why did you start the Heroin Awareness Committee?
I started it because of my experiences with my son. So my son was 16 at the time. He began using prescription opiates due to a wrestling injury when he was 15 and was exposed to those drugs through a legitimate injury, but that gradually progressed to a heroin addiction. He loved the way they made him feel. They made him just kind of took away all his cares and took away all his worries, and he was able to, you know, just feel wonderful when he took them. And so in August of 2009, he started using heroin, which at the time I had no idea that he was doing that. And I found out in February of 2010, so about 6 months later, after months and months and months of trying to figure out what was going on. I knew something was going on. I just didn't know what it was. His attitude had changed. He was angry all the time. He would disappear for hours at a time and wouldn't respond to my text messages or phone calls. He was ditching school. He dropped out of the sports that he was doing. You know, his attitude changed, and a lot of it was adolescent type behavior. So there was a big part of me that was thinking I was just being paranoid, that he was just, you know, spreading his wings. He was 16 years old at the time, and he was just, you know, becoming a teenager, basically. And I chalked a lot of it up to that. But then, you know, looking back and now knowing what the warning signs are, it was all over the place, and I just didn't see it. So once I found out that he was doing it, that it was heroin, which I was extremely shocked because I had no idea that heroin was a problem in our schools or communities. I thought that was something from the 1970s that people just didn't talk about anymore. Then we started treatment options. I mean, once you find out your loved one's a heroin addict, you just hit the ground running with everything that you can find, everything that's available to you, which isn't much. But we tried everything, and he struggled for 2 years, and he passed away August 13th of 2011 of a heroin overdose. And he passed away in his bed. He had been in jail, and that's another effect of heroin addiction is eventually they're going to have to steal to support their habit, and eventually they're going to do things that they wouldn't normally do, and they're going to get arrested eventually. I mean, it's just a path that most heroin addicts take because that's all they care about is the drug. And all the ethics and everything else kind of go out the window. So he ended up in jail 2 weeks after he turned 18. And he was able to bounce off and on between periods of being clean and sober and periods of relapse for about the next year. And then he overdosed on August 13th and passed away in his bed. So that was my driving force, was him. I don't know if I found myself in this. I think looking back, I probably thought that I was putting myself in a protective bubble because it's like, well, if I do all this stuff, then it can't happen to me kind of thing, you know, which was completely, you know, idiotic for me to even think that. And I don't think I outwardly thought that, but I think that that's kind of my motive, was that, you know, if I do this stuff, if I can find all these treatment options, I can get connections, I can save my kid this way. This is the way that I can save him. And little did I know, I couldn't save him from himself. I couldn't save him from the addiction. He was the only one that could do that. And in the end, it won.
So can you tell us about Cameron?
I mean, he's a great kid. He had a lot of potential, a lot of very smart, played sports ever since I can remember, since he was probably 4 years old. I think he was playing soccer, you know, running around, his little soccer shorts that went down to his ankles. And he was very active, and he was very much a perfectionist. Very hard on himself, wanted perfection. and very good in school, took honors classes at La Cueva, very well liked, lots and lots of friends. And that was part of the devastation, as he had so many friends. And then when he passed away, all those friends, you know, just melted because it was just so hard for them to digest what had happened to him. I heard them say this multiple times. Well, if it can happen to him, it can happen to anybody, because he was the last person they expected this to happen to. His drug addiction was purely accidental. I mean, I honestly believe that. And I think with most kids, that's the case. They don't set out to become drug addicts. They don't wake up one day and say, hey, I'm going to go use drugs until I, you know, become addicted to them. They just don't do that. It's accidental in most cases. And before they know what happened and what hit them, they're already in it and they can't get out.
So do you mind talking about his addiction?
His addiction started out, like I said, with prescription painkillers. I don't know that he was ever addicted to prescription painkillers. I never really found that out. I did ask him if he thought he was addicted to prescription painkillers, and he said that he didn't know, but he knows that he loved the way they made him feel. And so I think for some people, they think prescription drugs are okay because they're legal and they're prescribed by a doctor. And a lot of times they get them from their parents or their parents' medicine cabinet, but they don't realize they're addicted until they stop taking them, until they try and stop. So with him, you know, I don't think he ever really knew if he was addicted to the painkillers. But when he started using heroin, he progressed pretty rapidly. He had told me that he started smoking heroin. He didn't inject it right off the bat. He was smoking it, which is how most kids do it. He started about once a month, just casual use. Then he was every other week. Then he was just on the weekends. And then eventually it was almost daily, and it snuck up on him, I think. You know, he thought he had it under control. He thought, well, if I only use on weekends, I'm okay. Or I'm only smoking it, so it's not that addictive if you're just inhaling fumes. I'm not injecting it. I'm not using a needle. And then eventually, almost a year after he started using, he had to start injecting because his body, the smoking, the heroin, wasn't enough to satisfy the cravings and the need that his body had for the drug. So he had to start injecting it to keep from getting sick. His, you know, with heroin addiction and even opiate addiction, it's not too visibly outwardly obvious, not like meth, you know, where you're physically deteriorating, your teeth fall out. I mean, you can see a visible sign. You lose weight with heroin. So he lost a significant amount of weight and just pasty skin, white pasty skin. He just looked terrible. I mean, he looked like death warmed over. He looked like, you know, I took pictures of him right before he went to rehab. And then I saw him when he got out, and it was like a completely different kid. So the visible signs were subtle, but yet they were there. You know, you could see them for sure. And when he moved from smoking heroin to shooting up heroin, I didn't notice. I didn't know that he started shooting up. Like, there wasn't a difference where all of a sudden I knew something else was different. Something else had changed. I didn't know that he'd started shooting up until he went to rehab, and they told me that he was injecting, and that's how I found out. The injection process for him was a mental addiction. I mean, he became addicted to the needle more so than anything. It was the feeling, the ritual. And I've heard this from other people too, that you become addicted to that process, to the needle, to that whole thing. And smoking heroin is bad. And you can become addicted to heroin, smoking heroin. But once you migrate to a needle, then your odds of recovery significantly reduce. So he went to several stints at rehab. When someone's addicted to opiates, the withdrawal and the detox process is about a 4-day long event that is excruciatingly painful, excruciating. Never seen anything like it in my entire life. A lot of young people, because we don't have a detox facility to handle adolescents in Albuquerque, they have to do it cold turkey on their own, a lot of times in their home. When they want to get clean. So in order for them to get to be able to go to a rehab, they have to get detoxed first. And it's most kids can't make it through that part of it. They end up relapsing and using because it's so painful to get through that process. So he went through that several times, and he was bound and determined that he was going to fight it and win. But the truth of the matter is, it's just not that easy. It's just not something you can just decide not going to do it anymore. It takes a lot of therapy and a lot of commitment and a lot of change in a young person's life that I don't think he was ready for. I mean, at 17, 18 years old, the last thing you want to do is give up all your friends, change your entire environment, possibly move to another state to get away, change everything about what you know because that reminds you of the drug use. Even though a lot of these, some of his closest friends weren't using, it was the association. It was all of that is coupled together in this lifestyle that becomes who they are. And they have to change that in order to get better and to stay better. And when you're that young, you don't want to give up your friends. You don't want to give up your lifestyle. You don't want to change.
So how did you find out about his addiction?
He actually ended up telling me. I was struggling with trying to get him to go to school. He was a junior at the time, and he would leave my house in the morning and not make it to school. He would leave my house to go to school, and he would never make it there. And we live pretty close to La Cueva, so I was like, how are you leaving the house and not making it to school? I went and met with the school, and I was just like, we got to come up with a plan so we can make him go to school because, you know, this isn't working. Something's got to give here. And the counselor mentioned to me that the school had an issue with heroin, that there was a heroin problem. And it was the first time I'd ever heard it. And I was just kind of like, oh, that can't be it. You know, that's not it. So she referred me to an adolescent counseling program here in the city that a lot of the schools refer people to. And so I took him there like 4 or 5 days later. And the counselor that we met with is very skilled at interviewing adolescents and trying to figure out what the underlying issues are. And she pretty much point blank asked him what kind of drugs he was taking. And he told her, and I was sitting in the room at that point in time, and he said that he was on heroin. And she kind of looked at me and she was waiting for me to react. And I didn't know how to react because I really didn't know what heroin addiction was or meant. All I knew is that I was relieved that I finally knew what in the heck was going on. I was kind of like, okay, whew, now we can fix this. Now we know what it is. There's got to be a fix for it. There's got to be a solution. And I had no idea what it meant to be a heroin addict.
So what does it mean to be a heroin addict?
I think it's a very lonely existence for the people that struggle with the addiction. It's a family disease. It's not something that people can just stop. I give some people credit because they are, but it's a very lonely existence that's where you wake up in the morning and your mission is to get your fix. And that becomes your breath, your water, your air. It becomes your life. And so you alienate all your friends, you alienate all your family, the people that you never in a million years would ever dream of hurting, you hurt, you steal from people that you love. Heroin becomes your primary focus, and that's all you care about is getting the drug, getting the fix. Because you know if you don't get the fix and you don't get the drug, you're going to get sick.
So I know that Cameron wrote songs and was a rapper.
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel to know that the students at the Media Arts Collaborative Charter School are using his words and his song to raise awareness about addiction, really?
I think it's awesome. I think, you know, working with Blake and the kids at Max has been phenomenal because these are really good kids that saw one of their good friends die, you know, right before them. So they have a passion about spreading the message and so that other kids don't fall victim to what happened to Haley and Cameron. And Cameron's words are his life. So he would write lyrics to these songs a lot of times when he was in jail or when he was in rehab or when he was clean, and he would write about his struggles, and they're very raw words and they're very real. And he was in Tucson, he lived in Tucson for 6 months in a sober living house, and he did really, really well. And we had, you know, helped him pay for someone to do a recording of one of his songs in a professional environment so that he could put it on CD. And he did 4 different songs, one of which is the one that Max is working with. And it was professionally done. It was awesome. They did a great job. The sound quality was great. And he got like 100 CDs burned with the songs on it. And so when he got back to Albuquerque, I mean, he was definitely on the path to trying to do something with his music. He was very proud of his music, and he was very proud of the fact that it was his life, that he was writing stories about his life. So he was handing out copies of his CDs to anybody he could find that would take them and listen to them. And you know, he was very talented. So I think he probably, you know, if he would have stayed on that path, music was a good detraction for him from the drug. It just wasn't enough, you know, to keep him clean forever.
Yeah, I heard one of his songs, and it is really amazing. And it's just listening to his words, it was really powerful.
No, thank you.
So I was wondering, do you have a message for parents out there about heroin or opiate addiction?
my message is obviously don't think that it can't happen to you. That's one of my biggest messages, is because I would never thought it could happen to me. I mean, I'm, you know, middle class family, have a good job. I, you know, make good money, live in the Northeast Heights. And a lot of parents are like that. And even the parents that think that, yeah, their kids could experiment and happen to them, you know, even I think they don't understand the ramifications of this type of addiction. So that would be my main message. And my other message is that if your gut feeling is telling you there's something wrong, act on that gut feeling, do something. I mean, you know, I'm not saying drug test your kid, because there's a lot of trust issues with that. But if you do feel like something is wrong, something's off, and you can't put your finger on it and you don't know what it is, it could possibly be, they could be abusing pills. They could be abusing prescription drugs. They could be abusing heroin. Not everybody starts off with heroin. So if you ask your kid, are you using heroin? They're probably going to tell you no. Even if they are, they're probably going to tell you no. But kids don't start off by, you know, smoking heroin. They start off with prescription drugs, and it gradually progresses to a heroin addiction. But ask them, even if you have a really good relationship with them, if there's something that's off, something in your gut is just telling you that there's something wrong, what's the worst that could happen? Maybe it's negative and maybe everything's good. Or maybe you uncover that not everything's good. And I can tell you from experience and from watching some of my son's friends struggle with it, they'll do everything in their power to keep you from finding out. So they will lie and manipulate, and they are very good at that. And they don't want to be found out, because then that means that they have to, that you're going to force them to get help and to get treatment. A lot of times they don't want to do that. My message is both to parents and to kids, mostly parents, because I think kids, you know, we tell them not to use drugs. We preach to them not to use drugs at an early age. Everybody, I think all kids know drugs are bad. I don't think there's anybody that has the wool over their eyes that thinks that drugs aren't bad. But kids will be kids, and kids are going to experiment, and kids are going to try things. And a lot of times it doesn't matter what we tell them, and it doesn't matter how many times we threaten them or ground them or take things away or follow them around and chase them. You know, it doesn't matter how well you know their friends' parents, all of those things. Kids are going to be kids, and kids are going to make stupid decisions, because that's what kids do. And that's part of growing up.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us about this very sensitive issue. I really appreciate you taking the time and giving us a lot of good information.
Thank you. Thanks, Melissa. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jennifer Weiss, for sharing your story with us. It's amazing to realize that New Mexico has the highest rate of heroin overdose, yet the state has no treatment facilities for youth.
Many people do not realize the difficulties heroin addicts face, and many do not know about the prevalence of heroin and opiate addiction in New Mexico.
Cameron loved music and wrote and recorded his own songs.
Jennifer gave Sound Oven one of Cameron's recordings to remix for their project. This, in Cameron's own words, is his struggle with addiction. Here is Sound Oven, featuring Cameron Weiss with One Way Track to Hell.
Out of the slime and darkness it comes to inflict its life-destroying poison on the careless, the unwary, the unprotected.
Just one weekend in a bathroom full of homies, I was introduced to something that is foamy and tells you and promises you will set you free. But I'm thinking to myself, does this substance even know me? No, but the obsession does. As you drift into an eye-slouching buzz, you just smelt the fragrance, felt the temptation, and y'all already know here comes the justification.
Life-destroying poison.
Pretty soon you don't even mind melting into that compound that's known as the devil's rebound. It's consumed you now and you've been tricked. You don't even know where you're headed. All I can say is you're diverging from the one-way track to heaven. You've been redirected to a one-way track to hell. Well, it only gets worse from here, because now you've taken the initial fear and watched it disappear. The care is gone. It's hard to get it back. Your mindset is whack once you've taken the step to the point of no return. You are puppeted and sick, and the devil's power you are fixed when you find your rig to hit the vein and prolong the sickness that still remains. The normality of the routine, it seems. The drug itself is taking a toll on the brain and the way you think. The utter brink of insanity, but in the mind of an addict, it's like, fuck it, I'm strong, I'm me, I can do anything. You've been redirected to a one-way track to hell.
Well, it only gets worse from here, cause now you've taken the initial fear and watched it disappear. The care is gone, it's hard to get it back. Your mindset is whack once you've taken the step to the point of no return. You are puppeted and sick, and the devil's power you are fixed when you find your rig to hit the vein and prolong the sickness that still remains.
There are many people and places dedicated to helping and raising awareness about heroin and opiate addiction. Now we will share with you some of that information.
Throughout the show tonight, we featured original music by Sound Oven. To learn more about their campaign and project, visit indiegogo.com/soundoven-youth-media.
Sound Oven has great songs and messages. I really like music that has a socially conscious message to it. It's a great way to make people think about issues while entertaining them.
Albuquerque really does have a lot of cool projects. We have awesome events and organizations that talk about real things affecting people in Albuquerque and New Mexico.
As we talked about last week in part one of our heroin and opiate addiction awareness show, the Heroin Awareness Committee in Albuquerque is dedicated to making sure that everyone knows about the problem.
Their website offers great information about heroin and addiction. For more information, please visit saynotoheroin.org.
If you have a loved one suffering from addiction, there are weekly NAR-Anon meetings. NAR-Anon members are relatives and friends who are concerned about the addiction or drug problem of another. For more information, you can go to their website, naranon.org, or contact Elaine Gutierrez at 505-974-3152. You can also contact Jennifer Weiss at 505-363-9684.
Meetings are every Monday from 7 to 8 p.m. at New Beginnings Church, 3601 Montgomery Boulevard, Northeast.
To learn more about heroin and opiate addiction, check out KNME's New Mexico Public Square episode about heroin and opiate addiction online.
This is a candid conversation with recovering addicts, parents, and officials talking about the issue here in New Mexico and what needs to be done. That marks the end of our show for tonight.
We would like to thank Steve Paternoster and Jennifer Weiss for joining us and sharing about this sensitive subject. Thank you for your courage to share your grief and loss so that other parents may be saved from such tragedy. Thank you to Adrian Rivas and Melissa Harris for conducting these touching interviews tonight.
We also want to give credit to all youth involved in Generation Justice: Arturo Castillo, Sayer Key Town, Bashar Jawad, Rain Dodson,
Luna Olavaria Gallegos, Gara Jawad, Jasleen Mendoza,
Keone Beatty, Quinn Anderson, Adam Valdez, Victor Torres,
Jocelyn Tafoya, Brandon Bitsui, and Travis Aguilar. Production by Melissa Harris, Adrian Rivas, and Roberta Rael, with editing by Kamaria Umi.
Thanks to other Generation Justice staff for ongoing support, George Luna Pena and Isaiah Smiley.
And of course, our delightful director, Roberta Rael.
If you would like to podcast our segments or see the music playlists, you can go to KUNM.org and search Generation Justice. You can also check out the playlist and our website, generationjustice.org.
To find us on Facebook, search Generation Justice. You can also follow us on Twitter, @GenJustice.
Tweet, tweet.
I was your host, Hadiga Reddy.
And I was your other host, Adrian Rivas. Spoken Word is coming up next.
Remember that if you or someone you love is suffering from addiction, it is never too late and there's help out there. For more information, please visit saynotoheroin.org.
From all of us here at Generation Justice, good night.